Dr. John O'Hare is a research analyst in planning and research for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and John is going to share with us about the older adult in the 21st century, especially some of the statistics and what we have to look forward to in concert with what Dr. Bergman and Dr. Weiss had to say. So at this time, I'd like to introduce John.
Thank you very much, Professor Weiss. It was when Dr. Weiss first asked me to be a presenter at this symposium, I mentioned to him it was somewhat disconcerting to be considering my own aging, because I will turn 50 next year. So in talking about aging in the 21st century, I'm going to be talking about my own aging. I think in terms of talking about varieties of reality, and I think Shirley first introduced that this morning in her discussion, and certainly the diversity of aging itself in individuals, as Dr. Weiss talked about just now, we see all of that in the social data on the older adult population. I thought it might be interesting or appropriate to begin by noting a rather fascinating bit of trivia. In 1946, the initial year of the baby boom, the first edition of Dr. Benjamin Spock's Baby and Child Care was published, as well as the first edition of the Journal of Gerontology. In effect, any discussion of aging in the 21st century must necessarily deal with the boomers, the oldest of which will turn 65 in the year 2011. This presentation will then review some recent trends and projections with regard to the older adult population, offer some likely scenarios for the boomers, and discuss, perhaps more importantly, the unfolding relationship between the church and the aging baby boomer population. Now, unless we forget, living to advanced age and entering a life stage called retirement, in quotes, are both fairly recent phenomena. As recently as 1900, life expectancy was approximately 47 years. It's interesting, by the way, to note that the median age at first marriage for males was about 26. So when they said, until death do we part, they meant probably about 20 years. Now, while we have added 30 years to life expectancy at birth since 1900, we've only marginally increased life expectancy at 65. It's been on the order of about 5 years. The most dramatic improvements in mortality have come in terms of surviving childhood and adolescence. In other words, you were allowed to get to adulthood. Certainly, retirement, as we have known it in the past 30 years or so, is largely a post-industrial development. More importantly, as Ken Dickwall reminded us in Age Wave, we're not just living longer, we're getting better in many senses. By virtually any objective measure of well-being, certainly socioeconomic well-being, the average person of 65, 75, or even 85 years today has a quality of life considerably better than their grandparents or even their parents before them. One rather dramatic indicator of the relative improvement of the economic situation of most older adults is the steep decline in the proportion of elderly living below the poverty level. By the way, international comparisons suggest that much of the industrialized world has experienced this same type of reduction. In effect, since the 1960s, older adults have gone from about 30% below poverty to slightly above the proportion of those 18 to 64 years of age in poverty. And in effect, children now make up a much larger or more significant part of the poverty population than do the elderly. Changes in Social Security eligibility, the indexing of benefits in the early 1970s, and increased coverage of workers by private pension plans have all contributed to a trend toward early retirement since 1950. If you show that. In effect, we've reduced the median age at retirement by roughly 4 to 5 years. And the reduction has been approximately the same for both males and females. While physical limitations may hinder certain activities among particularly the advanced aged, those 85 and over, most older adults report few limitations and assess their health as good or excellent. All of us I'm sure have seen the data that suggests that only about 5% of the population 65 and over are in nursing homes. Recent data also indicate that Social Security is an important source of income for the average older adult, though wages and pension income contribute significant shares of income for growing numbers of those age 65 and over. As you can see in these comparisons, Social Security accounted for approximately 40% of the average older adult's income in 1990, with wages and pensions or annuities providing for slightly less than one-fifth. In terms of expenditures, housing, food, transportation, and health care, in that order, are the four major costs for most older adult households. At least as of 1990, health care costs consumed approximately 10% of the average elder household's budget. And there's been a dramatic shift in terms of what composes that health care expenditure. By 1990, over half of that expenditure was health insurance as opposed to health services and so forth. Though this overall picture for older adults is one of great improvement since the 1950s, there are indeed exceptions. Many non-white older adults and many women of any race over age 75 are more likely to be living below the poverty level than is the case for older adults in general, due to either a lack of pension coverage and or work experience or history dominated by low-wage jobs. Older adult women living alone account for 40% of all the single householders in this country. 40% of all the single adult households in this country are women 65 years of age and older. Now, in terms of prospects for the boomers and some projections. As I mentioned, the oldest boomers will turn 65 in 2011. They will turn 50 in 1996. Due to the middle aging of the boomers, the fastest growing age group during the 1990s will be the 45 to 54-year-olds, primarily because you have the entry number of boomers replacing a much smaller cohort in that age group. The older adult population, in fact, will not grow dramatically between now and 2010 because the small Depression-era cohort will replace a much larger generation born in the second two decades of this century. But after 2010, the boomers will fuel a rapid climb in the numbers of older adults, which will more than double between the year 2000 and 2050. And the advanced aged, those 85 and over, will grow even more dramatically, as you can see from the slide. In effect, the number of persons 85 and over will grow six times between the year 1990 and 2050. These, by the way, are the latest projections out of the Census Bureau. They were published in November of 93, and they replaced much earlier projections. According to these projections, the older adult population 65 and over will not go above 20% of the population, because there are new projections which dramatically increase the number of projected births after about 2010. What will aging and retirement mean for the boomers? Well, in a sense, their script is already being rehearsed by their parents. Better access to improved health care over the past 30 years, more income, and the resulting autonomy they bring have led to increased numbers of older adults, quote, spending their kids' inheritance, as the familiar bumper sticker proclaims. In a word, options are the central fact of life for increasing numbers of older adults. And at least the oldest boomers, that is, those born between 1946 and 1955, will enjoy those same options and more. The outlook for the younger boomers, that is, those born between 1956 and 64, is perhaps less sanguine. With a few cautions, the following are offered as some likely scenarios for most of the boomers. First, most of the boomers will retire before 65, but later than 62, and a larger share of them will work after retirement than is currently the case. Secondly, over 25% of the boomers will have substantial individual retirement accounts, which Congress will again make tax deductible sometime between now and 2010. Third, three-fourths of boomers will have some private pension income. That's compared to a little over half today. And those incomes, those pension benefits will account for about 25% of retirement income, as opposed to about 14 or 15% today. Younger boomers may be the first cohort of retirees for which a majority have a defined contribution plan as opposed to a defined benefit plan. If you're aware, most of the people who retire today currently have what's known as a defined benefit plan. That is, the company guarantees you a given benefit if you've been with a company for X number of years and you retire at 65. The proportion of employees covered by those plans has been decreasing rapidly over the last 10 to 15 years, and now approximately a quarter of all pension plans offered employees are defined contribution plans, where the amount put in is up to you and your employer. Nobody guarantees you any given benefit at age 65. What has happened as well, those people who are normally covered by pension plans are normally in larger employers, mostly in the higher unionized manufacturing sectors. And as you can see by this, those areas that are growing most dramatically in terms of the number of jobs in the future, services, retail, and wholesale trade, those are all less likely to have pension plans covering. And the younger boomers tend to be moving into some of those areas more dramatically. Four, Social Security will still be the largest single source of income, primarily approximately one-third of income for most boomers, though it will be a smaller share than it is today. Some form of means test will probably be adopted shortly after the year 2000. In effect, there already is a means test, only it's just that retirees have their benefits, Social Security benefits, taxed if they have over a certain income. Five, some form of national health insurance will be adopted between now and the year 2000. Six, the average boomer will have 20 to 25 years of retirement. Most boomers will retire in place with a mortgage-free residence. Approximately 85% of persons 65 and over do not move out of the county in which they last were employed. And about 80% of those 65 and over own their residence free and clear of a mortgage. Life expectancy at age 65 will not improve dramatically for most boomers. And I say this not because I don't think there will be marvelous improvements in medical technology and medical advances between now and the year 2010, but I say this primarily because boomers, like most of the rest of us, don't take care of themselves as they should. And that's going to affect them probably more than anything else. Seven, boomer older adults will be more ethnically diverse. Non-Hispanic whites now account for approximately 85% of the 65 and over population. By the year 2050, they will account for less than two-thirds of that population. Boomers will rely more on siblings, less on their own children than did their parents. This is more a matter of their being born during a period of relatively high fertility where they're more likely to have siblings, and the fact that they reduce their own fertility themselves and therefore will have fewer children than did their parents. This raises some interesting questions about, too, the social aspects of aging. And finally, the year the author turns 60, senior discounts will end. Now, moving to the aging boomers in the church. How will older adult boomers relate to the church? Historically, religious participation and salience increases as one ages. However, various recent studies would indicate that aging boomers may redefine the relationship between older adults and the local church. While boomers have rediscovered the congregation, most who left during their adolescence or young adulthood are still out, if you will. And even those who never left barely resemble traditional members. Those of you who are familiar with Wade Clark Roof's A Generation of Seekers will know what I'm talking about here. He spoke of, in some ways, very traditional-looking church members who hold very non-traditional beliefs. Some early general social survey data on middle-aged boomers suggests that older boomers may well reduce their levels of active participation as their children pass through adolescence and leave the nest. David Rusin of Hartford Seminary, in some look at the general social survey data out of the National Opinion Research Center, found that the older boomers who have now reached middle age, once their children attained or became teenagers, were already beginning to reduce their participation, and that that decline continued when they became empty nesters. Assuming the recent data are correct, then some 50 to 60% of boomers who have returned will have returned to the church by the turn of the century. To put this in perspective, historically, something like 80% of those who left the church in early adulthood or adolescence eventually returned. What we're saying is that proportionately, somewhere between one-fourth and one-third fewer boomers, proportionately, will return to active participation in the church. But even those among those who return, about 10 to 15% will deactivate, if you will, as their children reach late adolescence or early adulthood. For those who do remain active members of a congregation, the evidence suggests that the local church may provide important social, emotional, and spiritual support. There is an extensive body of literature that I didn't go into in the paper, but you'll see listed in the bibliography, at least reviews of that literature, which suggests that older adults actively engaged in local congregations report higher levels of life satisfaction. They report fewer ills, if you will, subjectively. In effect, they have a better quality of life. In a study that we conducted in 1989 in conjunction with Southern Illinois District and Lutheran Children and Family Services of Illinois, we found that approximately two-thirds of older adults 75 years of age and over said most of their closest friends were members of their own congregation. That, I think, is a key finding in terms of the importance the local congregation can play in even the delivery of services to older adults and the utilization of the skills older adults have built up over a lifetime of experience. Just as older boomers were the first to rewrite the script at each life stage they entered, they will undoubtedly negotiate new rules or new roles for aging church members. Not content to simply accept ascribed member status, many older boomers will seek to make a difference. Others may alternate periods of relatively intense involvement with periods of detachment. How aging boomers relate with the local church may largely be determined by three very important things, I think. First of all, their desire to retain options and choices. Secondly, their search for balance, interesting, between affiliation needs and fulfillment needs, personal fulfillment needs. It's interesting. One of the findings that Wade Clark Roof posited in his study was that boomers are not just not interested in being committed. They will commit themselves if they find something that will make their life more fulfilling and in effect make a difference in their own lives. And finally, and perhaps more importantly, most importantly from our perspective, the congregation's response to the increasingly diverse older adults and their varied lifestyles. How the church relates and responds to the needs of older adults, boomers or otherwise, may have an awful lot to do with to what extent aging boomers stay active in a local congregation. Now, I would like to leave you with a note about the year 2011, which brings us around full circle. In the same year that the oldest boomers turn 65, annual U.S. births will likely exceed the highest number of births ever recorded, that's 4.3 million plus, at the height of the baby boom. So we have come full circle. And I thank you.
I guess next year I'll be 50 years old in April, one of those people that turn. And I, being in this cold room, I don't want to be put on ice so soon. What we'd like to do is that if you have a question, there is a mic over here. We're missing a mic over here, but if you would like to speak your question, I can repeat the question so we have this on tape so that our panelists can address it. I would first like to ask one question to Dr. Bergman to kind of get this going. We hear all about, you know, obviously we're already in this older adult generation and age, and we heard a lot of, I think, startling statistics and the aging process and everything that's going on. I think a lot of parish pastors and healthcare professionals, perhaps more parish pastors, you know, where do you begin something like this in the parish? How do you get this started to get the older adult involved?
Well, I think the Task Force on Aging, Synodical Task Force on Aging, has some wonderful models. Ed Schlimpert, where are you? Ed Schlimpert, back there, has a fabulous model that he shared during the break. And so he is one of the consultants who will go in and really help congregations figure out where they are. And he does that around Roy Brockup's functions of the church. And so I think he's got a very exciting model. We've developed some models at Seward, so it is out there, and CPH has a number of resources. The key really is at the seminary, so that people get beyond the pastor, so that the pastor is very interested. I think that clergy today simply do not understand the vast possibilities of aging, just as these two gentlemen picked up. It's really incredible. We've got to begin there, as well as other church professionals, and then we can just take off. So Ed's taken off, and he's flying.
Okay, do you have any other questions? First over here. Yes, sir. Okay, the question is, why is the prognosis for Social Security? Oh, what is the prognosis for Social Security for the boomers in the face of the abortion issue?
Okay, I can speak really only with regard to the latest projections out by the Census Bureau. Again, what they indicate is that there will be a slight decline in the number of live births probably into the early part of the next century, around 2005, but then a gradual increase so that, again, by the year 2011, we'll be exceeding 4.3 million births again annually. We, in fact, in 1989, the boomlet began, that is, the baby boomers had 4 million plus births in 1989, and that has continued at least through 92. I haven't seen the final data on 93 yet, but I'm assuming that it exceeded 4 million again. And that's primarily because immigration has really changed some of the assumptions about future population growth. I'll just tell you, the 1993 projections on total population in 2050 project a total population of approximately 392 million. That is 90 million more than they projected just in 1988. And probably 80% of that increase is due to raised expectations in terms of the levels of legal immigration. Oh, no, I think that from the data that I've seen, Social Security is probably financially sound probably to about 2030, and then you really begin to run into problems because the trust fund will build a huge surplus until about 2011, and then that surplus will begin to dwindle. What I'm suggesting, however, though, is that sometime between now and 2011, first of all, a means test will be applied to Social Security, which will, in effect, reduce somewhat individual people's retirement benefits to some extent, at least at the upper end of the income.
Okay, another question back there. Yes, sir. Okay, the comment is that rather than the clergy not recognizing the need to minister to older adults, they're recognizing it, but the older adults themselves not wanting to take that task on to be part of the community. Is it that way, or is it both?
Absolutely, you're right. You're accurate. It's both, and that's all part of the lack of knowledge base as well as ageism, because older people themselves have bought into ageism. They don't necessarily see themselves, you know, as sitting on a shelf, but other people. The question that I have with clergy is that it's so difficult to work with clergy. I find they're very open, so don't misunderstand me there. But it's so difficult for them to pick up and run with aging areas. They do, you know, run up against, I've served my time, let the younger ones do it, and so on and so forth, those kinds of things. But let me illustrate it this way. At Seward, we have now offered a family minister's master's program. We have people flocking to that program because family is considered crises. Older adult ministry is not. And so I think that what we need is a broad education, and that would help both clergy, DCEs, teachers, because we need the whole process of aging, beginning with early children and moving all the way through. So very definitely both.
Right here, first. So the question is, what's an intergenerational relationship? Do the young feel the older a drain, and do the old feel the young don't care about them? In one sense, who would like to address that?
Roger? I can tell you that in my experience, the older folks certainly believe that the world is becoming more impersonal. And the younger kids that we have the chance to rub elbows with feel the same way. And I think in general, society and relationships are suffering. How many of you feel as if you really get your money's worth from your personal relationship from your doctor? I will use that as a point of argument, that the personal relationship is what's suffering. And that most of my older folks are fairly pessimistic about those personal relationships being improved without some very creative and sincere effort in very basic areas of improving the family and getting back to basic issues about what's right, what's wrong, and how do we relate as human beings. I know that sounds very basic, but I can tell you that that medicine is very efficient and very cost-effective when the human relationship aspect of medicine is the thing that's most important. Because when you know your patients, you tend not to overdo, you tend not to underdo, you tend to do very efficiently. When you don't know your people, then we tend to get very insecure and overdo tests or underdo tests and do all kinds of crazy things, and that is a very inefficient system. The difficulty is the human relationship also is perhaps the most difficult thing to define because it's so unique, and it does take time. And it's difficult to get people to look at ways of really enhancing it, which is where the church, I hope, really spends some time and money and effort in shoring up that relationship.
Shirley, would you like to comment on that?
I would just like to say I think it's really important to get some intergenerational dialogue going so that when you've got boomers who might be saying, well, you know, we need to be in charge of this, or you see older adults saying, well, you know, let the younger ones do it, that dialogue together really is helpful. And if there's turf and territory problems in the church, for pity's sake, then the mission is too narrow. There's so much to do out there. Get out into the community.
Yeah, just a comment on that. When I was serving our Saviors in Springfield, we got the older adults involved in the, we had a Christian day school there. They were the grandpas and the grandmas, and they were going into the schoolroom tutoring. You know, they're valuable. Even if they only had a third grade education, they got a lot to contribute. And they're in there working with math and teaching stories about Christ, driving vans. And then that worked all the way up to the high school, so that they soon found out, you know, this is really a great relationship. So back to the issue of don't wait until they're in high school with all of these issues. You start dealing with it in the parish in preschool levels when, you know, 3 and 4. Even though they have grandparents, some don't, though. Another question back there. Yes, sir. The question is pressure. Is depression in the elderly appropriately diagnosed and treated?
No.
Next question.
You know, depression really is very undertreated and very underdiagnosed. Depression has an incidence in an outpatient population of, in some studies, as much as 20%. You know, of people that are studied. In a nursing home situation, it can be double that. When you think that the average depressed person has the same chance of dying as a person with a hip fracture, it becomes very important to diagnose and treat depression. And the prognosis of an older adult treated for depression, whether it's by counseling, medication, or both, has the same prognosis as a younger person treated for depression. So it's a highly treatable disease.
Okay, Dr. Klotz? This question is, the normal aging process is normal, not pathological. So what can we do to, in terms of our education, to help the older adult know, hey, this is normal. You know, you're not 3 bricks short of a load.
We take the viewpoint of educating people as much as possible, especially the families, and much more so than even the physicians. We really believe it's a grassroots effort. You deal with the bottom of the pyramid, if that's even the right example nowadays. It's amazing to me how many older adults do not understand the normal aging process and will assume that when they confuse the garage door with the refrigerator door, that it's normal. And it's not. It's probably Alzheimer's disease. But that's okay for an 85-year-old. It's not, but a lot of that goes back to ageism, goes back to all kinds of problems that society has been really unable to deal with. Very successfully, but it really is a matter of education, and I think that is going to change because it turns out that, you know, it's more cost-effective, and I hate to talk that way constantly, but that's the world in which we live. It's more cost-effective to get people to deal more realistically with what their expectations are of their normal aging process.
Dr. Klotz, another question? So the question is, what's the effect of the difference in life expectancy?
Well, I'm not so sure that exactly how to phrase it, but certainly what we see in the side of clinical medicine is we have a lot of women who live a very long time without their spouses and without a lot of support, intimacy, and satisfying relationships. And so it really behooves us to teach, especially younger women, you know, to really pay attention to building support systems and to developing relationships, because you will spend a significant amount of your life, you know, perhaps without a man, and also to teach people that when, you know, your husband dies, perhaps go out and get another one, if that's your bent, because, you know, there are a lot of second marriages and new relationships that can be developed.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I think it has some important implications, certainly financial implications for older women, as well as social, because social psychologists talk about life space, that is, the social arrangements that we have, the social connections that we have, and those tend to shrink for obvious reasons as you age. It's more critical in terms of older women because obviously their male partners precede them in death. Particularly with boomer women, with delayed marriage, median age at first marriage having increased significantly over the last 20 years, for the average baby boomer woman, it's probably likely that she's going to spend of her entire life a much shorter period in an in-family or a partnership relationship than any of her predecessors, which raises some issues certainly for in terms of older adulthood, in terms of social emotional support and spiritual growth in the later years. Another reason why I think, particularly in terms of older females, 75 and over, the congregation can be an extremely important resource that we really haven't fully tapped as yet.
Okay, Shirley.
I'd just like to add one other area, and that is in the spousal relationship. Oftentimes we think of dependency, interdependence, and independence. It's critical that women also are a part of interdependence and independence, because in later life, when they are alone, they need skills. And today, many skills, financial skills, so on and so forth, may or may not be there, although women are taking charge and moving out and learning so much. But nevertheless, we see women who have great difficulty if they have remained dependent in the relationship and not come to an independence in terms of spousal relationships.
Okay, way in the back there. Yes, sir. So the question is, in terms of the pension, John, do your statistics, you know, preclude government workers, or is this in total?
No, these data included all non-agricultural payrolls, which includes government, and they're included under the services.
What's the significance of the $4.3 million that you talked about in terms of, in two different points of time and in terms of the total context of population?
Right. In terms of the $4.3 million in 2011, they will make less difference than did the $4.3 million born in 1956, for example. But later on, right around 2030, births then will increase to slightly over 6 million a year. So what I'm suggesting is that even a few years ago, there were relatively much fewer births projected well into the next century, and primarily because there were certain assumptions about immigration, legal and illegal, which obviously didn't hold after the 1990 census. They had to revise those projections.
Okay, we had some comments up front over here. Yes, sir. The question is, because of the erosion of the moral family values and the economic and social decay of the world, is euthanasia going to be just one of those things that's going to be happen to deal with the population?
I can...
Pardon me?
I'm talking about specifically
towards the elderly.
I don't have a very accurate crystal ball. But I can tell you that most of the people that I deal with, probably somewhere between 40% and 50% of the physicians, feel that passive euthanasia is acceptable. Active euthanasia is still felt by most of the doctors and most of the stuff I've read to still be out of bounds. However, there is great pressure to move towards a looser definition of life, euthanasia, age, and people in general. I don't know what will happen, but I believe that some of us who still believe that there are absolutes and still believe that there is right and wrong will have to stand for that very acutely someday. Whether or not we'll be able to work and stand for that is another issue. You know what I mean? I am not sure exactly what will happen in that regard. But I think there will be great pressure to loosen the reins of that particular animal. And I can already see it happening because it's really an economic issue at this point. I can tell you that many hospitals we go to, the financial vice presidents, who are good people, will stand up and say, we like old people, we think it's great to take care of them, but please send them to the other hospital, because every time you admit them to our hospital, they lose us money. So it's very difficult under our current system to deal with that efficiently. And I think morally it's going to create a great deal of difficulty.
Shirley?
That's why I think it's imperative that we do something in terms of, and I use the I use this term loosely, a theology of aging. I don't know how to bring this together, but that's got to be a part of it. We've got to talk about aging from birth to death so that we can stand together with a united front, because it's a very slippery slope. What I didn't tell you, it's in the paper, is that someone was telling me last week that her father he's saying, I'm going to be dying, I'm going to take my own life. And it's not a question of whether I should take my life, but the question is, when should I do it? I mean, it's critical. It is really critical.
Just one comment I'd like to make. Pastor Groth, who will be speaking tomorrow, we were talking last night, and I'm working with Dr. Ian Hamer from Australia on the issue of human personhood and ensoulment. And what we're finding in the reading and the people I'm talking with is this issue, these terms, pre-embryo, pre-fetus, and now I'm reading pre-human, which becomes a moral out to deal with infanticide and euthanasia. And many of these terms that are being proposed are being proposed by amphibian embryologists in many cases and being taught that way. So that, I'm really interested in this because it has a direct relationship with aging and working with older adults. Okay, Leo? The question is, why do we have so many hopeless Christians? Roger?
Sin.
Present company excluded.
That's right, sin, right. I just think that society is breaking down, as many of us have observed. This has been observed, obviously, throughout time, as all of us have studied. You can't read the Bible without being struck by how soon they thought the end was coming and how bad they thought their society was. Ours doesn't seem to be a whole lot different, except there are great pressures and ramifications on people to live by means other than faith. And when you ask people to live by faith, it's risky business, and you can't have faith in anything less than an absolute God and be safe. And I am struck by how many people are just unwilling to put their faith in an absolute God. They would much rather put their faith in themselves or some agenda or something that they can better touch, feel, grasp, understand, read, or interact with. And it is frightening because the pressures seem to be getting greater and greater to move to a relativistic lack of faith type of context in which to live. And I don't think people have changed all that much over the years, and certainly the older people that I am privileged to deal with tell me that life isn't really all that different. It's basically always been the same. God presents his challenges and his gospel, and it's pretty much laid out before people, you know, and still most people seem to reject it.
Okay, in the back. Yes, sir.
That, but in my viewpoint, the reason that folks would want to take their own life, would want to go home to be with God, would want to live hopeless, useless lives, is because they don't have any type of health in context of physical aging, certainly. They are insistent, oftentimes, on being dependent. They know nothing else. When you go to some older person in a nursing home who is just kind of crabby and sitting in the corner and doesn't do anything with her life and is perfectly capable of visiting her neighbor and saying, well, I realize you can't see, you can't hear, and life is very difficult for you, but you can make a difference. Let us help you make a difference. It is frightening how many people tell us, no, I'm just going to sit in the corner and die. And is it, you know, the people who that is their method of self-destruction, that, again, we're back to folks who just refuse to accept the power, you know, that they have to live. Because I can assure you that when a person tells me they are hopeless and they don't have anything to live for and they're ready to die, I can almost show you a very sick relationship pattern. And that when those people are supported, when they are loved, when they are given worth in the middle of their terminal illness, I mean, just because you're dying of cancer or Alzheimer's disease doesn't mean you stop being a father. Doesn't mean you stop being a husband. And we can give people that dignity to the very end of their existence. I believe that that is not only possible, I believe that's the design of the human being. But we have lost our capacity to do that because we have become so focused on disease and technology and getting a good result that gets us the highest reimbursement. We have lost the focus of the person and the relationship we're supposed to have with the person that really gives the person their worth.
Shirley?
I would just add one thing, and that is, again, I really believe that we need to articulate the personal call, the personal purpose that one has that is throughout the lifespan, and then affirm that personal call, so that when the questions come down to later life, we know whose we are, but we also know that we are here for a reason, so that frail people do have a ministry, such as Roger said, telephone calling or cheery greeting. There was a former prophet, Seward, who had he was a Parkinson person, and he shared with me at least 7 or 8 roles. Now, the man could hardly talk. It was very difficult to understand him. He was a voter in church. He was a citizen. He did this. He did this in the nursing home and that in the nursing home and so on and so forth. The man, the way that we would look at this person, had so many physical disabilities, and yet he had roles. He had a ministry.
Okay, 2 more questions in the back. First, Dr. Bergman.
I really can't speak, Ed, in terms of the rest of the colleges. I know that I think RF has a master's in gerontology, which is great. I really see that the Concordia University system will be doing a lot of sharing, because we've got to have sustained continuing ed. And I think that that's going to be happening. That will be one of the major strengths of the university system, because we're going to be exchanging faculty and so on and so forth, and with telecommunications. So I think there will be major changes as the boomers reach that area. And, it's just like the Missouri District is so strong in terms of their own model. That's what has to happen. And I think that certainly Concordia Seward is doing some work.
Okay, Travis?
Ministry with.
That's one of those.
All right, ministry with. She started her own telephone ministry. How about a hookup in terms of other people in the congregation, a telephone conference call? There's the prayer ministry, I believe, has such a long way to go in terms of development, of where we really are pulling people in. My dad sits in a chair, and that's it. And we thought he was going to die several times this year. The validation of the roles of father, of grandfather, and so on and so forth. But that prayer ministry, he's modeling to us through the tapes that he listens to and so on and so forth. So that has to be fleshed out. You're absolutely right. But it's got to be ministry with frail people.
Okay, Art. Time has run out. I think the presentations this morning have just been really very, very excellent. And I'd like to thank our presenters one more time for their fine presentations and their discussions.